The next case on our calendar is 08-2133 and 08-2228, State of Ohio versus Richard Underwood. Ms. Madsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors, opposing counsel. Kelly Madsey on behalf of the State of Ohio and the citizens of Montgomery County. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for the purposes of rebuttal, if I may.
Your time there.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state is before the court today, first and foremost, to answer the certified question of whether an agreed and jointly recommended sentence is authorized by law under Revised Code 2953.08D1 and therefore not reviewable, where the agreed sentence includes convictions for offenses which are allied offenses of similar import. And the state submits that the simple answer to that question is yes. Support for that conclusion may be found in the language employed by the legislature in the statutory provision itself. Also in case law, which distinguishes between a court's authority and the court's exercise of that authority. And finally, in case law from this and Ohio appellate courts, which champion the protection and finality of plea agreements. Looking first, Your Honors, to the language used by the statute itself, because the rules of statutory construction dictate that we give meaning to all parts of the statute. And in doing that, it's apparent that the legislature in this statute recognized a difference between a sentence which is not authorized by law and one which is merely contrary to law. And that is apparent in the fact that under the grounds for appeal articulated in the statute, which is under the chapter governing appeals and post-conviction remedies, Division A4 creates a grounds for appeal that the sentence is contrary to law. However, those grounds for appeal are made specifically subject to the exception created in Division D. And D1, the reason the state is before the court today, provides that where a sentence is authorized by law and jointly recommended by the parties, it is not reviewable. And the state submits that that essentially is a codification of the recognition that we want to protect agreements of the parties. Where
counsel, had this been some other agreement that would have been not statutorily correct by and it was agreed to. All right, and let's do it a different way. Let's say that it's a provision that says that there is no probation for a certain type of offense, and yet the prosecutor and the defense attorney and the judge all agree in open court as part of the plea deal that there is probation that is afforded the offender. What would you say under those circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, in likening community control to the way this court has treated post-release control, I understand they're treated a little bit differently. And I would submit that I know community control is treated differently from PRC, post-release control. Touching on that, on post-release control, and making the distinction there first.
Post-release control, we know what happens there. Mm-hmm. I'm saying if the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney substituted for what is on the books for the appropriate sentence with a sentence that is not on the books, what do we do?
I would submit that there are two differences in that situation. One would be like PRC, community control would be a term included within the sentence itself. And the reason I was referring to PRC or post-release control would be where an actual term of the sentence is missing, that would be something that the court did not have authority to issue. As to community control, the same may be true. If there is a required term of community control, and I apologize, I don't know that community control would be mandatory. That may, again, be something that's discretionary and not something the court is required to impose as part of the sentence. In reviewing cases regarding community control, I believe courts have remanded sentences which fail to issue that notice regarding community control and treated that as an error which doesn't void the sentence, but merely removes community control from the sentence. So I think that would be different than what we're dealing with here. What we're dealing with here is merely an error that the courts have treated as an error in the exercise of a court's authority or in the exercise of the court's jurisdiction, and not an error that goes to the court's authority itself.
But the court doesn't have authority to impose a sentence that is contrary to law.
The state's position is that those are two different standards. And the fact that the support for that position can be found in the fact that in this statute, the legislature intentionally used those two different phrases. Especially in the area of valid offenses, the error is not always plain. It's not discernible from the record. While it may amount to plain error on review, the fact that it is a waivable error or an error in the court's jurisdiction or in the exercise of the court's jurisdiction is in fact what distinguishes it from an error in the exercise of the court's jurisdiction as opposed to an error of the court's authority in the first place. And the state would submit that those are two different questions. The first question would be, did the court have authority to impose a sentence? And the state would submit that this statute, that's where the inquiry would stop. Did the court have the authority to issue the sentence? And as the conflict cases found, authority would merely mean that the statute or the sentence, excuse me, would be within the permissible statutory range. The second question would then be, is there error in the exercise of the court's authority? Is there an error that we can recognize as plain? Was there an error in the exercise or the imposition of the sentence? But as I said, the state would submit that the statute effectively removes agreed sentences from that second question and recognizes that where parties have come to an agreement as to a plea and a sentence, the legislature wanted to protect that contract between the parties from attacks which go neither to the agreement, the validity of the agreement between the parties, nor the court's authority.
So this case arises on a conflict between the second appellate district and, among others, the eighth appellate district.
Correct, Your Honor.
You think that the second district is in error in its determination. What specifically did the second district do that you take issue with here?
Specifically, Your Honor, the Second District Court of Appeals defined authorized by law in a way that allows any error, such as an error with regard to allied offenses,
yes,
to rob the court of its authority. And as I was just stating earlier, we submit that there is and there must be a distinction between errors which affect the court's authority and errors merely in the exercise of the court's authority.
Well, counsel, the idea of defective sentences and what happens if there's an error in a sentence, depending on what type of error it is, we have those cases that talk about the sentence being void and so on. Are you saying that the parties can insulate from appellate review a sentencing as long as they agree to it? In other words, you know, if the parties agree and make a contract, as you say, they can insulate it from further review, and they can insulate it also from the argument that the sentence is void?
No, Your Honor. The state's position is that if the argument is that a sentence is void, that argument goes to the court's authority in the first place. But as the conflict cases argue or found, and as the state would submit, the court's authority is merely whether this sentence is within the permissible range. As far as insulating the agreement of the parties, the contract between the parties from other attacks that go neither to the knowing and voluntary nature of the agreement itself, which of course that would still be available. Parties in plea agreements or in guilty pleas still have the ability to attack the voluntary nature of the agreement, and that would still be available. Also, as I said, arguments or allegations that the court's authority was exceeded in issuing the sentence. for an example, the post-release control, a mandatory term, a term that affects the court's authority, or what sentence the court could issue, those attacks would remain valid.
So you're saying that if the parties agreed to a sentence that did not include mandatory post-release control, that that would be appealable because that was not, or that was a void sentence, is that right?
Correct, Your Honor. I believe the way this court has treated post-release control, it has treated it as a mandatory term, and there's actually a piece missing from the sentence itself. And where the piece of the sentence has not been handed down, there in effect is no sentence, and the court did not act within its authority. So that would remain an issue, the way this court has treated it, that would go to the court's authority and not merely whether the sentence is contrary to law in some other respect.
I guess I'm having a trouble distinguishing the definitions or between not authorized by law and contrary to law. Help me out. How would you distinguish those two terms? Because what I hear you saying is that if it's contrary to law, that's really serious and that'll get you a void sentence. But if it's just not authorized by law, that can be indelibly marked as being what the defendant is subject to and the prosecutor is bound by.
Your Honor, I think it would be just the opposite. The state's position is that if a sentence is not authorized by law in a way that the court has exceeded its jurisdiction in some way, then the sentence would be void.
If it's not authorized by law, then it's void.
Correct, Your Honor.
And if it's contrary to law?
If it's contrary to law, there's merely, and I would submit that the legislature recognized that errors may occur in the imposition of sentence, and specifically created this statute to remove agreed sentences where a defendant has stipulated to the correctness of the sentence and has therefore waived waivable errors, has waived those arguments. The legislature specifically acted to remove this from appellate review and protect that contract between the parties from allegations that go neither to the validity of the agreement nor the court's authority.
Does the doctrine of invited error come into your analysis at all?
I believe it does, Your Honor. The state submitted in its second proposition of law that the doctrine of invited error is ignored. If we were to say that where a party has bargained for this sentence and has come to the table and presented the court with an agreement and has stipulated, the language this court used in State v. Porterfield was the defendant has stipulated to the correctness of the sentence.
Did the defendant here have a burden to raise the issue of allied offenses with the trial court in the first instance before presenting it to the appellate court?
Before presenting the agreement to the court?
Before presenting the willingness to plead no contest to the four counts.
If I understand the court's question, is does merger need to be addressed prior to the agreement?
Actually, the defendant in this instance pled no contest to four separate counts. Am I correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And the no contest plea would not be admissible in some subsequent civil proceeding to collect back the money that had been stolen from the consumers involved in those transactions.
Correct.
So there's a reason for the defendant's activity. The question I'm trying to get you to address is, at the time that the defendant agreed to plead no contest to those four counts with the agreed sentence, did the defendant have a responsibility to address the trial court and suggest that these may or may not be allied offenses and ask for sentencing on one or conviction on one and not all at that time before bringing this issue to the appellate court?
I believe so, Your Honor, because I believe that would go to his understanding of the agreement, the validity of the agreement itself, if you will. If there was an allegation that that merger would apply or that he would not agree or that this agreement would not be knowingly and voluntarily entered into if merger were not addressed, that would go to the voluntary nature of the agreement. And I do believe the state would submit that that is an issue that the defendant or the appellant in this case should have brought to the trial court to address that issue if that affected the knowing and voluntary nature of the agreement itself.
Counsel, I'd like to ask just a factual question here. Does the record affirmatively show that there was no separate animus for these crimes?
Like many cases where we're dealing with a plea, there are, I'll distinguish it. In many cases where you're dealing with a plea, there aren't facts. In this case, there was a sentencing memo which did discuss a lot of the facts. In this case, Mr. Underwood was charged with 2 counts of aggravated theft and 2 counts of theft, all relating to thefts that he committed through his position as a housing contractor. He was charged for an aggregate amount stolen from 3 separate families. And in the aggregate amount of exceeding $100,000, he was charged with 2 subsections of aggravated theft and 2 subsections of theft, that being beyond the scope and by deception. So I think the facts in this case, and I believe the state discussed this in its sentencing memorandum, that there would not be a separate animus in this case.
Okay, so that is conceded in this case?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Ms. Manzi, the defendant, as you know, argues that we should not apply invited error to an entry of a court that is entered without authority, or doesn't have authority to enter that entry. What's your response to that argument?
The state's response would merely be that, again, we need to distinguish between a court's authority and the court's exercise of that authority. And I believe this court has done that in Payne, in State v. Payne, went to lengths to discuss the difference between errors in a court's jurisdiction and errors in the exercise of that jurisdiction. So to argue that the court cannot accept plain error from, or that cannot discuss invited error with regard to the court's authority, disregards the first question that the state has submitted, which is that this is certainly within the court's authority, and that within the court's authority, the legislature has specifically removed questions of plain error when we're dealing with a waivable error.
Are all entries that are entered without authority contrary to law?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe any entry that would be without the court's jurisdiction, without the court's authority, would in fact be contrary to law. And the state would just submit the opposite is not true.
All entries that are contrary to law are not entered without the authority of the law.
Absolutely.
Your argument.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ms. Madden.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Calhoun.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, opposing counsel, the issue in this case is a jointly recommended sentence is reviewable when it fails to merge allied offenses. The plain language of 2953.08d tells us that a jointly recommended sentence is only not reviewable when it is authorized by law.
Counsel, I want to test how that works in the real world, because in case after case after case, probably the majority of the cases are settled by plea. And the plea bargaining process reduces most sentences from the original charges, correct?
Yes.
And there are probably countless pleas out there where this issue exists, where there's allied offenses that could have been merged had you tried the case but were pled to separately. So if we affirm this, all those cases would be subject to appeal now, correct?
Your Honor, ultimately, Mr. Underwood's procedural posture is that he came through a direct appeal. And his plea was not to a sentence that encompassed unmerged allied offenses. Mr. Underwood's plea was to an aggregate 2-year sentence. Ultimately, it was up to the trial court to make sure that that sentence was crafted in agreement with statutory requirements.
Well, usually you also agree to what exactly you're pleading to. You don't usually agree to just a term. Your defense attorney agrees to, I'm going to plead to X, I'm going to plead to Y. The judge then sets the aggregate term. Correct?
That is correct, but in Mr. Underwood's case, there is nothing in the record of the plea or the sentencing to indicate that allied offenses were ever even discussed with Mr. Underwood, which just emphasizes that his plea was really
about. Let me go back to my question then. Even if they were not discussed or if they were discussed, any case now that has allied offenses that should have been merged if you tried it but were pled to as part of agreement are now subject to appeal and reversal, under, if your theory holds.
For the cases that still have an appellate vehicle, yes.
Okay. And then does that also then apply to any cases in which you pled to lesser included offense that if you had tried the case would not have worked, but it was part of a plea?
The distinction here seems to be the allied offenses are a statutory requirement. And in all fairness, I did not look at lesser included offenses in my brief, but that seems to be, there seems to be more room to move.
What happens if you plead to legal fiction, such as attempted carrying concealed weapon, which I frequently took pleas on? You know, how do you attempt to carry a weapon into court and fail? But we took a lot of pleas like that. Are those all then subject to appeal?
I think the situation here is just the difference between the state and the court's discretion in determining how to ultimately convict someone versus what the Ohio Revised Code and constitutional requirements apply to sentence.
So if I can summarize your position, every single plea now can no longer be a legal fiction of any sort. It has to be in exact compliance with what would have happened had the facts been tried.
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that the court is bound by such a narrow rule. I think rather this is just a question of when we have sentences that stem from agreements, we have to apply all of the statutory sentencing requirements, which is not just going within the range, but includes the merging of allied offenses under 294125.
And what do we do to the doctrine of invited error if we find that your clients did not raise this issue at trial, did not contest it, and in fact agreed to it, and now wants to appeal it? What do we do to that doctrine? Does it no longer apply?
Invited error does not apply in Mr. Underwood's situation for two reasons. One, as we were discussing earlier, Mr. Underwood did not plead to a sentence that encompassed unmerged allied offenses. He ultimately pled to an aggregate two-year sentence.
How do you plead to a term and not to actual offenses? I don't understand how you physically do that.
I don't mean to suggest that he didn't plead no contest to each of the four offenses of theft. He did.
And he knew what those offenses were were charging.
He understood what the challenges contained.
So he did plead to certain offenses.
There is no question he did plead to those four counts of theft, and he understood what those counts were. But again, there is no discussion on the record at plea or at sentencing to indicate that Mr. Underwood understood that these were allied offenses.
So if you invite error but you don't understand you are, it doesn't matter?
I wouldn't say that, Your Honor, but one, I do think we have to look at the context of what he's actually pleading to, but also 294125 implements the Double Jeopardy Clause, so now we have a constitutional question. And Mena versus New York, which the Underwood Court relies on, tells us that a guilty plea does not waive those constitutional challenges.
But he didn't plead guilty. He pled no contest to
Correct.
Try to preserve it and failed to raise with the trial court the issue of allied offenses. He can waive a constitutional right. Why couldn't he waive his right to a statutory merger?
Well, merger under allied offenses seem to have both a statutory and a constitutional dimension. So here, the Mena logic still
precisely
seems to
apply. My point. He can waive it, and by failing to present it to the trial court, he was only interested in getting the agreed two-year sentence. He never said, by the way, this is an issue the court should consider.
Well, I would ask the court to think about two things here. One, the Mena court, Mena versus New York, does decline to...
Pardon me?
Mena versus New York does decline to answer the question of whether or not a defendant can ever waive their double jeopardy claims. So that's certainly a somewhat open question. But I'm sorry, would you mind just restating your question for me one more time so I can answer it completely?
Well, I'm trying to have you address the concept that had your client raised with the trial court the fact that these were allied offenses, though I have entered pleas of no contest to all of them, the court should consider before imposing sentence that some of them may be allied offenses, or we presume that this count merges with that count, and ask the trial court to consider that, rather than accepting the sentence and then subsequently going to the Court of Appeals without the trial court having the ability to address the notion of consideration on allied offenses. And normally we would say if a defendant fails to raise it in the first instance in the trial court, it is presumed waived and cannot be the subject of appellate review.
Mr. Underwood's case is distinguishable because this is a situation of plain error. And that second district line of cases has all consistently applied plain error and not applied the invited error doctrine.
I understand it's plain error, but isn't that encompassed in the fact that it was waived by the defendant?
Mr. Underwood did not waive his challenge to allied offense. There was forfeiture, applying the logic in Payne, but we would strongly disagree with the idea that Mr. Underwood waived his claim since this is a plain error situation, or that he, that there was waiver, or that there was invited error here.
Counsel, in order to waive, doesn't he have to realize what he's waiving? And there's no record that indicates that he knew what he was giving up here.
Exactly, Your Honor. Again, this is a situation where he's pleading to an aggregate term, not understanding how those allied offenses could be merged.
What prejudice inures to your client as a result of this determination?
Ultimately, Mr. Underwood is serving concurrent sentences, so there won't be any additional prison time, but the prejudice does come from him having additional convictions on his record. And at least several of Ohio's courts of appeals have found that does constitute prejudice.
What would that be practically?
In terms of, whatever effect that might have in his moving out in the world, trying to find employment, additional convictions on his record is always going to be a more onerous burden to any former inmate. The state has argued that authorized by law means within the statutory range only, and for that reason, a sentence can be authorized by law and not reviewable but still be contrary to law. Mr. Underwood argues that contrary to law is simply the logical inverse of authorized by law. 2953.08d was not intended to preclude review of sentences that openly flout statutory and constitutional requirements. And this court gave some indicator of that in State versus Porterfield, saying we have to look at 2953.08 as a whole, not just in its individual divisions. Additionally, there are some significant public policy considerations that this court should consider. The state argues finality in sentencing, but it seems that a trial court who is responsible for crafting a sentence that is in compliance with statutory and constitutional requirements, a trial court's responsible for crafting a sentence that complies with those laws, and it's ultimately the failure to do so that undermines finality in
sentencing.
Counsel,
as far as this particular situation, who should have raised the issue of merger? Or how should that have been discussed in this particular case? Was it the responsibility of the trial judge or of counsel for the defendant? Who should have done it?
Your Honor, ultimately, it's the responsibility of the trial court. But as the state pointed out, the state did concede that these were allied offenses in their pre-sentencing memorandum. But Mr. Underwood would argue that it's ultimately the responsibility of the trial court to ensure that when they craft a sentence, it complies with all of the statutory requirements.
Was that pretrial memorandum available to defense counsel?
I'm sorry, so pre-sentencing.
A pre-sentencing memorandum available to trial counsel?
Yes.
So the trial counsel was aware, knowingly aware, that there was a waiver if they got a memo that said these are allied offenses?
We can only assume that defense counsel would have read that sentencing memorandum and known that the state...
You don't think the defense counsel read his own client's?
I certainly hope he did, Your Honor.
So there is something in the record to indicate that your client may have known about the allied offenses at the trial court and then failed to present it.
Again, there's nothing in the transcript of the plea or the sentencing which would have been the time to have that dialogue with Mr. Underwood.
Well,
granted, there is that concession in the memorandum, and we acknowledge that.
Before a sentence?
Yes. But it was up to the trial court to make sure that Mr. Underwood understood how his sentence was being crafted and what its ultimate effect was going to be.
Well, there's no challenge to the activity of the trial judge here, is there, other than just imposing the sentence that the parties agreed to?
Well, ultimately, it just becomes a question of reviewability. I don't believe that it's framed as the trial court's actions. Just to go back over the idea of plain error, a trial court that imposes a sentence in conformity with that allied offenses statute is plain error. The Second District has a long line of cases applying plain error, and ultimately this court did affirm at least that logic in State versus Wynn, although this court was addressing whether aggravated robbery and kidnapping were allied. It did ultimately affirm State versus Wynn, which applied a plain error analysis to this line of cases. I would just emphasize that the error was not waived because this is a situation of plain error, and also because Mr. Underwood's no contest plea does not waive his challenge to multiple convictions on double jeopardy grounds. And I'll just briefly conclude if there aren't other questions. All sentences that are subject to statutory and constitutional are subject to statutory and constitutional requirements, and a sentence that fails to conform to those requirements is not authorized by law and is therefore reviewable under 2953.08d. We would simply ask that this court affirm the ruling of the Second District. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cahoon. Ms. Madsey, you've used your time, which may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. To just briefly address the question that was raised at the beginning, the state would submit that if, for example, the statute prohibited a community control or a probation term for an offense like rape, then the court would not have the authority to go ahead and impose, even with the agreement of the defendant and the state, to impose probation for that offense. That would not be within the court's authority to do that. However, the court would have authority with the party's agreement to impose sentences for offenses such as kidnapping and rape, where the parties have agreed to enter into a plea agreement to those offenses, and as the conflict cases demonstrate, even impose consecutive sentences on those offenses, where that agreement represents the agreement of the parties, and the parties have agreed to waive errors such as that the offenses would be allied.
Wouldn't this be a lot clearer if in the plea agreement the defendant waived any objection or claim to a merger for allied offenses?
Would it be?
I know the argument is that if we affirm the Second District, that this is going to upend plea agreements because nobody's ever going to be certain as to what is agreed to is actually going to hold up. But you can change your plea agreement to reflect the terms that the defendant waives any right to claim a merger, couldn't you? Not you, but the prosecution, the state?
Correct, Your Honor. I think that idea ignores the state's position, ignores the necessary distinction between authority and contrary to law. Could the defendant...
Let's assume we don't agree with your argument. I understand your argument, so I'm not...
Sure.
But assume for purpose of argument that we do not agree with that, this plea agreement matter could be handled so that it doesn't become a pervasive problem, could it not?
I believe, absolutely, Your Honor, the defendant could come in and say, I stipulate that I'm not going to merge these offenses. I understand merger, and I agree that I'm not going to have any appealable issues with regard to merger. He certainly could do that. The state would simply submit that the failure to do that, especially in cases where when we're dealing with a plea, the facts of the case aren't available. And in many of the conflict cases cited by the state, the facts of the case and whether or not these would not just be allied but mergeable, whether they involve a similar import, is not available. So the state would just submit that the defendant should not be required to specifically address the issue of merger, where that issue affects only an appealable issue, avoidable error, and not the authority of the court or the validity of the agreement of the parties. If I could just briefly summarize, Your Honors.
Very briefly.
The state would just request that based on the plain language of the statute itself and this court's recognized protection of plea agreements as articulated in State v. Porterfield, the state would just ask the court to reinstate the agreement of the parties and reinstate Mr. Underwood's convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.